In the first part, we just looked a bit about general topics. We looked a bit in the future, so to say. Now I want to go a bit first the other direction. I want to show a bit about, or tell a bit about the history in microprocessor development. And okay, let's talk a bit about the beginnings. I think everyone of you know Moore's Law. This law is named after Gordon Moore. And this is one of the big names in the beginning of computer architecture. Together with Robert Noyce, these two have founded a company which is called Fairchild. Fairchild Semiconductors, Mountain View, California in 1957. And this company was the first company which produced integrated circuits. So the first integrated circuits were set up or were built by Fairchild Semiconductors, still today a vivid company. So if you look at, if you open one of the computers, so you look at the chips inside there, you will probably find one with the brand Fairchild on it. And Gordon Moore was the president and Robert Noyce was the chief in design and development in this company. And most of the today's planar process technologies used for integrated circuits, in fact, were created by them and were invented and implemented in this company. This was as well the time where Moore's Law was born. So this was a time where Gordon Moore made his prediction about the increasing complexity of chip design. And interestingly, this prediction came true over decades. It's still true. And it's the most cited statement about exponential growth of transistor count in integrated chips. And there are two versions of Moore's Law. One tells about the doubling of the transistor count, which tells every 18 months the transistor count in the chip doubles. And the second version is the number of gates on a chip, and the number of gate on a chip doubles each 2 years. So this is if you look at in literature, you see this doubling with 18 months, or see this doubling with the 2 years, and one refers to the transistor count, and the other refers to the number of gates. And so this is the initial publication Gordon Moore made in 1965. And here you see the logarithmic chart starting from 1959. It's a two logarithm, which means, okay, in 1959 we had one transistor on the chip. Then we had 2 to the power of 1, 2 transistors, 4 transistors, 8 transistors, 16 transistors, and so on. And this was published in 1965. So you see here, up to 1965, you observed this linear growth when you have a logarithmic scale, overall a logarithmic growth then. And he predicted, this was a prediction, that this continues up to 1975. In his first prediction. Today we have 2011 and this curve is still valid. So as well here was a sketch about the main manufacturing costs of the components per integrated circuit. You see there is some kind of a minimum, a local optimum. And in 1962 this optimum was about 10 transistors on a chip was optimal. We could as well produce chips with more than 10, but they were more expensive. In 1965, the optimum was about 50, and in the 1970s, the optimum was about more than 1,000 transistors on a chip. So this is was predicted to be there. In fact, you have to keep in mind that this publication is from 1965. So these two curves. Well, measured curves, and the 1970 curve was a predicted curve. So this was the initial publication of Gordon Moore on Moore's Law. And Moore was as well involved then in the foundation of Intel. Again, Noyce and Moore, 10 years later, found a left fragile and founded a company they called Intel. And the main idea was, up to that point, computer memory was mostly magnetic memory. They had this magnetic ferrite core memories. And of course, these memories are very, very bulky and has very low capacity, very energy consuming. And they had the idea to replace this memory by a semiconductor-based memory. And this is why they then founded the company called Intel. And quite soon, Intel became one of the leading companies for the production of integrated memories. So this was the root of Intel was the memory production, and even the development of the dynamic RAMs, the DRAMs we're still using today, was as well created by Intel by a man called Andy Grove. So if you look at the microprocessor development from 1957 up to 2010, you found in 1957 the foundation of Fairchild Semiconductors and the production of the first integrated circuit. Then in 68, the foundation of Intel and the production of memory chips, dynamic RAMs. 1974, the Intel 4004 as the first processor chip, followed by the 8008 in the same year, and the 8080, I think 2 years later. Then in 1984, we have the Intel 32-bit CISC architectures, mainly represented by the Intel 268, 368, 468 processors. Then in about 2000, the Pentium processors by Intel, Pentium, Pentium Pro, Pentium 2, Pentium 3, Pentium 4. In 2003, about the ER64 architecture represented by the Itanium chips, introducing the EPIC architecture. EPIC architecture as well, an architecture we'll cover in this lecture. And today, the core processors, first the Core 2 Duo, Quad Core, and the Core i7, which is the current up-to-date Intel processing chip. So this, the development over the years with the growing complexity. To give an impression of the growing complexity, I just have here a tabular, starting with the first Intel microprocessor, the 4004, developed in 1971, 2,300 transistors on a chip, a structure or feature size of 10 micrometers, and a maximum clock frequency of 740 kilohertz. 1 year later, or mostly the same year, at the 8008, with 3,500 transistors, same feature size, almost the same clock frequency. And the main difference between these two was that this was a 4-bit processor and this was an 8-bit processor. Then in 1974, the 8080, which was for long times the quasi-industrial standard for microprocessors with 6,000 transistors, 6 micrometers, clock frequency of 3 megahertz. 1978, then the 8068, the first 16-bit processors. So still 8-bit here, 16-bit processor with almost 30,000 transistors, 3 micrometers feature size, and 10 megahertz clock frequency. 1982, then the 8268, with more than 100,000 transistors, 1.5 micrometers, at 12 megahertz, and as finding here was introducing for such features like virtual memory management, for instance, what has been firstly introduced in the 8268. So this, the 8068 still had this quite hard. So from the possible memory, we're here at 64 kilobytes maximum memory. Here we had a maximum of 1 megabyte. Here we have then. 16 megabyte maximum memory. Then the 8368, the first 32-bit processor by Intel with 275,000 transistors, 1 micrometer feature size, 33 megahertz clock frequency. In 1989, then the 8468 with 86 with more than 1 million transistors, 800 nanometers feature size, and the clock frequency of 15 megahertz. And the main difference between those two were that a floating point coprocessor and a cache has been added to this one. It's the main improvement. Then 1993, the Pentium with 3.1 million transistors, nearly the same feature size, 800 nanometers at 66 megahertz. And the main reason for renaming it were legal issues, because you cannot have copyrights on numbers. So the problem is, from the normal numbering, this would be the 8586 processor. But the problem is we cannot get a copyright on numbers, and there were other companies like AMD, for instance, which as well sold 8486 processors, the same name, and they could do this without any problem. So Intel decided to change the name to something which they can get a copyright on. And so they, instead of having the 586, they called it Pentium for Creek 5 in 1993. 1995, and then the Pentium Pro with 5.5 million transistors, 600 nanometers, and 200 megahertz clock frequency. Then 1997, Pentium 2, 9 million transistors, 315 nanometers, and 300 megahertz clock frequency. 1999, Pentium 3, 9.5 million transistors, 250 nanometers, and 600 megahertz clock frequency. 2000, then Pentium 4 with 55 million transistors, feature size of 180 nanometers, and 2 gigahertz clock frequency. Okay, 2001, the Itanium, different architecture, 25 million transistors, same feature size, 800 megahertz clock frequency, but it was different architecture, so this is a ER32, and this is our ER64. This is a 64-bit processor. This is an Intel ER32-bit processor. Then 2002, the Itanium 1 was quite poor. The Itanium 2, with 220 million transistors, 180 nanometers feature size, 1 gigahertz clock frequency. Okay, 2006, then the Core 2 Duo, first dual core processor, 291 million transistors, 65 nanometers, clock frequency 3 gigahertz. The next is a Core 2 Quad, four processor cores on the chip, with 582 million transistors, same feature size, 65 nanometers, 2.4 gigahertz clock frequency. Then 2009, the core line, Core i3, Core i5, Core i7. I've chosen here the Core i7 with 731 million resistors, 45 nanometers feature size, 3.3 gigahertz clock frequency. And just released this year, the second version of the Core i7. So from the internal Intel naming, this was the Netherlands microarchitecture. And this is a Sandy Bridge microarchitecture, now having almost 1 billion transistors, 995 million transistors, feature size 32 nanometers, clock frequency 2.5 gigahertz. And if you look here at one line at the feature size, you see starting from 10 micrometers in 1971, we are at 32 nanometers, so we have almost a factor of 1,000, not yet, but we're quite close to it, but the feature size is getting smaller, and we will come to the 10 nanometers in the next years, no problem. But with the consequences I mentioned earlier, that the hardware is getting more and more unreliable, the smaller the feature size will get. Another interesting trend you can see is from the clock frequency. We have a steady growth in the clock frequency up to about 2000, and then it somehow gets stuck. So 2 gigahertz, 3 gigahertz, 2.4, 3.13. Even the new Core i7 has a lower clock frequency than the older Core i7. This is due to thermal issues, quite easily due to thermal issues. And to get rid of the problem is as higher the clock frequency, as more the power dissipation is. And so what you're doing is you try to reduce the clock frequency, but even increase the performance by other computer architectural measures. And this is as well something which we'll cover in this lecture here. Okay, you might ask how the microprocessor itself was born. What was the initial idea to have the microprocessor? And in fact, this was a project, a common project, a joint project of Intel and a company called Bisicom, was a Japanese company which is building pocket calculators. And Bisicom ordered the construction of a new pocket calculator by Intel. And up to that time, pocket calculators were built quite with separate specialized chips. And the Intel designers, Ted Hoff and Federico Faggin, had the idea to make some kind of a general purpose design, not only usable for that pocket calculator, but as well for other pocket calculators. And their idea there was, okay, why not copy concepts we know from mini computers? At that time, mini computers like the DEC mini computer, for instance, were quite popular. Mini computers means this was a computer in the size of a wardrobe, not a room, but a wardrobe. And why not just copying ideas of these mini computers and just put it on the chips we are doing so well? So we have currently, Intel was building memory chips, was quite good in integrated circuits. Why not just bring this concept to chips? So instead of development of several special chips, they proposed a new concept, which this concept was just oriented on the up to now mini computers. So they combined the functionality to one microarchitecture with an own instruction set, and this was quite oriented on the DEC mini computer on that time. And the entire chipset consists of four chips, 4001, 4002, 4003, and 4004. But the 4004 was the control unit, and this 4004 contained the entire instruction set, which was oriented on this DEC machine. And so, in fact, we had a microprocessor. So it just combined elements of a mini computer to one chip, resulting in the microprocessor. And here you see the original announcement in the electronic use, which was here, I think, in 1971. Interestingly, the 8008 came as well from a corporation. Here was the DataPoint Corporation. The DataPoint Corporation was developing data terminals. And Intel tried to make as well the control of a data terminal by the same means. For the pocket calculator, a 4-bit chip was sufficient for the terminal. They needed an 8-bit chip, so it developed the 8008. Interestingly, the project failed because the chip was too slow. So in a pocket calculator, speed is not that problem. So if this, you must imagine we have had reaction times in milliseconds here. And for a pocket calculator, if you get the result in 10 or 20 milliseconds, it does not care for you as a human. But when you want to use the same to control a data terminal, where you have a cathode-ray tube with a beam you have to control, you have real-time constraints, and milliseconds is too slow for that. So it was not usable for that, so the project failed. But the resulting chip was a big success for Intel. They sold it as 8008, as the 8-bit pendant to the 4-bit 4004 processor. So, and this was the origin of many, many microprocessor families. Microcomputers with increasing performance starting from the 4004, 8008, 8080, what I had already, up to the Pentium and the Core series. And this was as well the reason Intel had big success with this. It was the reason why Intel retreated from the memory market. They stopped producing memories, which was their initial business, in fact, and they concentrated fully on microprocessor design. So this was the reason for that. Of course, there were others which were as well successful. We had other very important microprocessor families, for instance, Motorola with the 68000 series, which was quite comparable to the Intel's ones. So if you look at this, if you look here, the Intel 8068, the corresponding product from Motorola was the 68000 processor, which was a similar performance. And then it went up to the even to the Pentium. They had the 68000. How was it? I think 600 was the last one. I'm not sure about that, about the number. But as well, they followed and they had comparing products to the Intel nearly at the same time. As well. But then Motorola made a decision here at that time and said, okay, we abandon this line, because that year, about here, was a time where there was a new design paradigm in computer architecture took place. We'll talk on that as well a bit. Up to that time, the processors were so-called CISC processors. CISC stands for Complex Instruction Set Computing. Talk about later in a bit more detail what this means. And from here on, it focused, the processor architecture or the computer architecture focused more on RISC computing, reduced instruction set computing. And yeah, here Intel and Motorola went two different ways. Intel held for compatibility and kept the line, even with some tricks inside to deal with the new computing paradigm, while Motorola terminated this line and with the cooperation with other companies, especially with IBM, then Motorola focused on the PowerPC line. So while Intel decided to keep compatibility, Pentium processor as the last complex instruction set computer, Pentium Pro as the first reduced instruction set computer, but keeping on the outside the complex instruction computing paradigm, Motorola went a new way. They abandoned the 68000 series and came up with the PowerPC architecture. It was the last one, was the 68060. This was the last one, not 660. So the last one of this series was the 68060. And this was one was comparable to the Pentium. And even so, PowerPC is an acronym. It's a nice acronym. It stands for Performance Optimization with Enhanced RISC. It was a RISC processor, reduced instruction computer, and PC stands then for performance computing. Okay, Texas Instruments as well had, especially in signal processing, quite nice, or still has quite nice processors with the TMS series, TMS 320XX. DECompact produced the Alpha processor family, which has been abandoned a few years ago. Transmeter here was quite interesting with the Crusoe processor, which was a kind of morphable processor. I will later on in the lecture I will talk a few words on the Crusoe. On the low end, but this are the high, it's the high end part. On the low end part, on the microcontroller part, Intel and Siemens cooperated in the popular 8051 microcontroller family. Intel and HP cooperated with the Itanium family. Sun has a Spark family with the Ultra Spark. I think currently we are at Ultra Spark 7, is I think the current up-to-date version of the Ultra Spark. So you see, there were a lot of different successful microprocessor families and types. Okay. applications of microprocessors are widespread. So microprocessors and chips are, memory chips are used now in all today's processors, even the high performance computers, we're using microprocessors. So all operating systems are available for microprocessors, without any doubt. And we have applications on PCs, multimedia, workstations, embedded systems, smart cars, cell phones, palm tops, servers, high-end computers, computer nets. So microprocessors, you find microprocessors everywhere. Interesting and quite explaining is if you compare the Moore curve and some you consider some design gaps. So here, this is the Moore curve, the Moore's law curve, with a 59% growth per year here in gates per square centimeters or in number of transistors. And this, if this is a logarithmic scale, you get a linear curve here on that. And this curve is still true if you compare the Intel 4004 in 1969 with 2,300 transistors, or you look at the year 2000 with the Intel Pentium 4 with 55 million transistors, or you look at today, 2010, 2011, with the Intel Core i7 Sandy Bridge with almost 1 billion transistors. 995 million transistors. You see quite impressive examples for Moore's law. Now let's compare this growth with the growth of design productivity, which means this is the productivity of the designers of computer chips, microprocessors. And here we have a growth of 20% up to 25% per year. And this, of course, results in the design gap, increasing design gap here. So we have a really significant design gap, which means the chips, or the possibility to create more complex chip is growing faster than the possibility to design and to handle these chips. Yeah, and this explains something. This explains a lot of things. This explains mainly why we have today the many core chips or multi core chips. Because, okay, if for instance, if I have the opportunity to use to bring 1 billion transistors on a single chip, but I don't have the capacity and the possibility to design a microprocessor using these chips due to the gap, what I'm doing, just I'm replicating simpler processors. So what I can handle today is building or setting up a microprocessor with, let's say, 215 million transistors. And if I can bring 1 billion transistors on the chip, then I just implement 4 of these on one chip, on a single chip. This is no more needs in the design process. So I just replicate to use the gates I'm offered by Moore's law. And at least software architects say that this is a curse of the hardware they have to now to handle, because due to that we are due to this gap we are facing the multi-core processors. So we don't have more complex processors, but we have more parallel processors, which means we have more need in parallel programs, and parallel programs are quite hard to handle. They're hard to design. So software architects say, okay, due to the inability of the hardware architects to use the transistors, we, the software architects, now have to handle this. They're giving us highly parallel processors, and it's really hard for us to handle. And if you bring the software productivity in mind, you see the software productivity is even lower than the hardware design productivity. You have software productivity, a growth of 8 to 10% per year. So here you have an even larger design gap. So you can really say that the hardware is running ahead of the hardware design, and the hardware design is running ahead of the software design. And we really need to do something on that, because this gap, of course, due to this, is growing larger and larger. Okay, I already talked about change in paradigm in computer architecture. And I told the complex and the reduced paradigm, the so-called CISC and RISC paradigm. And to tell a bit more about that, to give a bit more information on that. So from the beginning of the microprocessor up to the 80s, about we had this this so-called CISC paradigm, complex instruction set computing. CISC, complex instruction set computing. And the idea was to make a really complex instruction set on the microprocessor, to give the microprocessor really complex and powerful instructions. Because up to that time, many programs were written in assembler. So assembler was a common programming language up to the 80s, right? And the programmer should have the ability or should have the possibility to use really powerful instructions. This was the idea of complex instruction set computing. So what we have to do is we have to, when then considering as well high-level languages, we have some kind of a gap. So we have here the processor microprocessor with his instructions, and we have the high-level language, whatever you mean, C, C++, Java, whatever you mean here, and here is a gap. And this gap has to be bridged by the compiler usually then. Yes, the compiler has to bridge this gap between the instruction set the processor offers and the instructions the high-level language needs. And to reduce this gap, to make this gap as small as possible, the developers try to make as powerful instructions or to implement as powerful instructions as possible to the microprocessor. So a basic technology used for that was so-called microprogramming. So which means just in brief notes that each instruction of the microprocessor internally was again executed by a small program, the so-called microprogram. These Intel processors of the x68, 8068, 8268, 8368, 8468, up to the Pentium were typical representatives of this class of CISC processors, complex instructions, really complex instructions, which means that you had many instructions. So usually a processor of that generation has about 200 to 300 different instructions, and instructions are quite really complex. Something like prominent complement complex instruction is something like decrement and jump non-zero. This is several instructions in one instruction. The decrement and jump non-zero is an instruction which, with a single instruction, can code a loop, which means you decrement an internal register, and as long as the internal register is not zero, you jump back to the beginning of the loop. So this is, with one instruction, you can code an entire loop nearly. Okay, in the 80s, a new concept was created or developed, which was the RISC paradigm, the reduced instruction set computing. And the idea was as follows. If you make the instructions more simpler, or more simple, more simple. Cannot make something more simpler, more simple. Then we might be able to execute these instructions faster. Complex instructions means, okay, it takes a long time to execute these instructions. Small, simple instructions means I can execute these instructions quite quickly. And the hope was there that overall the performance can be increased, so that it's faster to execute more simple instructions than less complex instructions. So, of course, if you have simpler instructions, you need more instructions to code an application. But the idea was, or the hope was, that even so, I need more instructions to code a given application, this application can run faster on the computer due to the more simple instructions. And this has something to do with pipeline processing. When we talk about pipeline processing in one of the next lectures, this fact will quite get obvious. Today, with the knowledge today, it's a bit hard for me to explain why this is true. When we look at pipeline processing, it's quite obvious to see why reduced instruction set computing is much faster than complex instruction set computing. So for the moment, you just have to accept this, that it's really, and overall, it's faster to have smaller instructions. And so the RISC idea mainly triggered the modern processor architecture, microarchitecture. So really all today high-performance microprocessors consist of an internal RISC kernel. And even those processors like the Intel processors, like Intel Pentium or Core family, which from the outside look still like this complex CISC processor, internally have a RISC kernel and an additional layer, which then transforms the complex RISC instructions to more simple, the complex CISC instructions to more simple RISC instructions. So we have on the outer interface, on the outer layer, we have, for compatibility reasons, still the CISC architecture, while internally the processors use a RISC paradigm. Okay. So after this brief look in history, we can start with the fundamentals in computer architecture. And I would like to start with some basic definitions. I already used several words without exactly defining them. And I want to do this now. I want to define the meaning of some words. And we talked a lot about computer architecture. But what does it exactly mean? So as an exact definition, the computer architecture defines the behavior and the attributes of a computer as seen by the programmer and the user. No internal structures or organization details, which means the architecture of a computer is the outside look of a computer. The computer architecture does not say anything about how the computer is built inside. It's just how the computer looks outside. It's, as well as, in construction, the architecture of a building is how the building looks from the outside. It says nothing about the inside of the building. As well on the computer architecture, so computer architecture says nothing on the inside. And this is the reason why, for instance, you can have two different computers which have the same architecture but look completely different in the inside. Architecture is just the outer level, the outer shell. And even this distinction made it possible that, for, as I mentioned before, that, for instance, Intel could change from the CISC to the RISC paradigm without changing the architecture. The architecture is the outside look, how the user or the compiler sees the processor. And this, they kept the same, while in the inside, they changed everything. But computer architecture just means the outside, while computer organization means the internal organization, the data path, the memory, the structure, input, output of a computer. So you can change the organization without changing the architecture, for instance. Two computers might have a completely different organization, but providing the same architecture, which means computer architecture in terms then what instructions the computer can do, what data formats the computer supports, and so on. This is what the architecture means. Organization means how it's built internally. If we go one step down to the processor, we can do nearly the same definition. So the processor architecture is, of course, part of the computer architecture and defines the view of the processor visible to the programmer or compiler developer. The interface between hard and software, as well, no implementation details. So the processor architecture, like the computer architecture, means how the processor looks to the programmer or to the application, the compiler. While how the inside look is, this is called the microarchitecture. The microarchitecture defines the concrete implementation of a processor architecture. So what we can have here as well, we can have several different implementations of the same processor architecture. Like, as I mentioned, for the Intel IR32, from Pentium, Pentium 2, Pentium 3, Pentium 4, up to the cores. And the operation principle then defines the way the processor processes instruction and data. And to bring this in one picture, You can see it here. We have the hardware and the software, and we have the interface between hardware and software, and this interface is what we call the computer architecture. So this is the computer architecture, and for the computer architecture, the inside of the computer is just a yellow box here. If we look inside, then we come to the computer organization. This is the actual structure of the computer, consisting of a processor, of memory, of input-output, of a connection system, which I've omitted here, the interconnection system, just to make this picture more readable. So this is then the computer organization, is how the computer looks inside, and the interface to the software is the computer architecture. And if we look further, of course, we have here then the processor architecture. So the processor architecture is, of course, part of the computer architecture, mostly a main part of the computer architecture. The interface between the processor and the software here. While inside the processor, we have the microarchitecture, the way really the processor works. And we have as well the operation principle, how data are processed. And this microarchitecture, another term for microarchitecture here as well, implementation, processor architecture and processor implementation is just another term for microarchitecture. Okay, then one very important part of the architecture, of course, is the instruction set. The instruction set defines the sets of instructions which are executable by the given processor architecture. For instance, if it's a RISC or if it's a CISC, and all instructions together form the so-called instruction set architecture. And since the instruction set architecture is, of course, the main part on how a processor looks to the outside, this instruction set architecture is often used as a synonym to processor architecture. It's not completely true because, to the processor architecture, there belong as well the data formats and the available registers, for instance, the processor offers, which is not direct part of the instruction set architecture, but of course, each instruction referred as well to data formats. Refer as well to registers in the processor. So the instruction set architecture, or shortly ESA, is often used as a synonym to processor architecture. If we stay at the instruction, then we can define the next term, which is an instruction format. The instruction format defines just the way the operands are accessed by instructions. So if you look at an instruction of a processor, instruction looks typically that I have a this instruction, that I have a thing which I call the so-called operation code, or shortly opcode, and this part tells what to do. For instance, to add something, to subtract something, to jump somewhere or so, and then I have the operands. And the opcode tells what to do with the operands. For instance, to add two operands or to subtract two operands. So the instruction usually is divided into an opcode, which tells what to do, and one or more operands tells what to apply the opcode on. And we can distinguish several different instruction formats, and the most common ones I have listed here. So the most common and obvious one is, of course, a three-address format. A three-address format means each instruction consists of an opcode and three operands. The first operand is a destination, and then two source operands. This is quite obvious for most operations. Something like, as an example, add C, B, A means take A, take B, add both together, and store it to C. C is given by A plus B, so this is a typical example for a three-address format. Of course, to implement a three-address format, you need some hardware, and if you look at the origins of microprocessor and computer design, hardware was an expensive resource, not as today. So the developers tried to find more or found architectures which do not have so much hardware costs. I tried to find simpler architectures. And so an alternate format, of course, is a two-address format. The two-address format consists of an opcode and only two operands, where the first one, at the same time, is the destination and the source. And the second one is a source. And how does this work? I can show it easily. An example would be add B, A, which means B is given by adding A plus B. So we have two operands, A and B. Both, firstly, work as a source. I have A and B, and I add those. And then I store the result back to B. This is a two-address format. And the advantage of the two-address format, of course, is simpler to implement. And it needs less storage. It's quite important. The size of an instruction is quite an important issue. We'll see later why. And of course, instructions using a three-address format need more memory. Instruction will be larger than having a two-address format. And just by experiments, you see that the two-address format has not much less performance than the three-address format. So still today, two-address formats are quite common because they save memory, they make the instruction smaller. And this is quite important, having instructions small, for several reasons. Okay, it's possible to be even more simple. The very first processors, for instance, the 8080, even the 8080, the third processor Intel built, were using the one-address format. And the one-address format consists only from an opcode and a source. You might ask, well, okay, if I have the opcode and the source, where the hell the second operand comes from, and where do I store the result? And here, there was one special register defined in the processor. This special register was the so-called accumulator register, and all operations are referred to this accumulator register. So add B means I take the contents of B, of the operand B, add this contents to the special register, which is the accumulator register, and store the result in the accumulator register again. And when I have only one such special register, I don't have to mention it in the instruction, of course. If I have only one accumulator, I don't need it to mention. Add B just means I take B, add it to the accumulator, and store the result again in the accumulator. So the accumulator accumulates the values. This was the one-address format. And this was quite common in the first microprocessors. And it's still a common format in microcontrollers. Today's microcontrollers still use this format. It's, of course, not very flexible, but it saves both memory and, as well, overhead in the implementation. And even a zero-address format is possible. A zero-address format consisting just of an opcode. And this is the so-called stack format. Java, for instance, Java bytecode is a zero-address format where you use the stack. So, of course, if you want to do C is A plus B, you first have to bring the two operands A and B to the top of the stack. So you have to do some push instructions. Of course, these push instructions have some operands. You have to bring somehow the operands on the stack. But the pure operation is without any parameters, without any operands. This operation add just adds the topmost two entries of the stack and then stores the result again on top of the stack. So what you do in a zero address format is you have a stack, it's a stack-based machine. You have the operand A on top of the stack, the operand B here. Then you add these two and then put the result here, A plus B on top of the stack. And after that, you have A plus B on top of the stack, then A, and then B. This is the stack looks now after the instruction. And as you, I think, easily can see, is if you have a sequence of calculations, it's quite easy. You just have to arrange these calculations in a clever way that you can omit most of push and pop. So you just push the initial operands you need on the stack. Then you do a sequence of operations with the parameters of the stack. And at the end, you pop the result from the stack. Even pocket calculators, there are pocket calculators, even for mostly a few little Packard, which use this UPN format. This is what we have, a stack-based architecture. Okay, I think that's enough for the first lecture. Next lecture, we'll have some more basic definitions, and then we'll start with the principles as well in computer technology and computer design. So let's see next Wednesday. That's it.